The following talk was given by Steve Hagen at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on July 4, 2010. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, I don't have anything prepared for today, so what I was thinking of was that we offer a lot of teaching here, and every now and then I just have a little Q&A. So maybe you have some questions about teachings you've heard here or things you've read or practiced. So anyway, here's an opportunity for you to ask, and let's just see what happens here. It's been a while since I've done this, so I probably should do it every now and then. So anything's been on your mind? Any puzzling thing? Yeah, Jay.
Just having watched a program that I taped a long time ago on public television. It was on happiness in my mind. And at the very end, they had a thing on meditation. And they were talking because they were going to have they went over to Tibet, or not Tibet, probably Dharma Bodhi, but where Dalai Lama lives.
Dharamsala?
Yeah. And they were going to do some testing, scientific. They were looking at both the scientific aspect of happiness and the beliefs and self-help groups and a lot of other things and what works and what doesn't work and what we know and what we don't know. And at the last moment, the monks decided not to do it, but then they sent monks over to the United States to test some of these things. And what they found out was it wasn't that the mind was really calm, but very focused on that, which certainly made me wonder if I'm not sure if my mind was that focused. But I was sort of surprised by the result that it wasn't the calmness was surprising. It was how focused it was. Now, I don't know how they measure this or whatever, but could you shed some light, because I don't think my mind is very focused at all, other than try to calm it down. And that's what those learnings were saying about meditation. Or you got to understand what I'm trying to...
Well, I'm not sure if I know exactly what you're asking.
I think that seemed to be very focused. They were very mindful. I'm sure the word was active, but certainly not necessarily just calm. It was just very focused.
Yeah, yeah. Of course, that's what the Buddha spoke of in the Eightfold Path. Right mindfulness, right concentration. That aspect of the mind, yeah, that's what's cultivated, yeah. Calm, well, maybe, maybe not. Calmness is something that maybe we bring to it, like, well, I want to take up meditation because I want to be calm. Yeah, well, that's fine. Maybe you will be, maybe not. In time, if you practice this, you'd probably be calmer than you were otherwise, but this meditation is not about getting anything. So those very concerns, and then measuring this and seeing, well, what's going on here? What are they measuring? Just different kinds of electrical impulses in the brain, that sort of thing. Yeah, well, right. We're fascinated by that, aren't we? I mean, we want, and then anything we can do to get some kind of grip or a handle on this. Yeah, that's what interests us, instead of just going ahead and cultivating this mind. In the end, well, what is it? Well, I don't know. There's nothing there to get hold of. What does it mean? Are you going to be calm? Are you going to be this or that? Well, yeah. What this practice, what this way is about is understanding, waking up to reality. It's not about getting something.
I understand your point on that.
Yeah.
The problem I was saying, maybe having is that when I sit, I just try to be there, but a lot of times that's just nothing's happening.
Yeah.
And right. So I was wondering if I'm missing something or
no. I can't, just based on that, I wouldn't say so.
Okay.
Good point. Things come and go, you know, and sometimes nothing much is going on.
Right.
Yeah. That's okay. It'll get busy enough soon. And then just let it go. watch for the grasping that's occurring in the mind. That's what we need to become aware of. It can be very subtle, but in wondering, am I doing this right? Am I getting this? Should I be doing this or should I be... All of these kinds of concerns are not important. When you find yourself asking these kinds of questions and wanting to get hold of one aspect of the meditation or another, well, wouldn't this be better? That's just our ordinary mind, reaching, grasping, fiddling around. Look at that. Look at that mind that's doing that. That's what you need to be aware of. Turn your attention to that. And then, of course, then we want to know, okay, so now what should I do about that? Well, that you understand that's the same mind. That's that same mind. See that mind for what it is. And, well, just see if you can just let that drop away. You don't have to be disturbed by it or bothered by it. You don't have to do anything about it. You just have to see how it is that we're constantly reaching in there trying to get hold of one thing or another, or to explain something, or I want to do this right, or can I get on the beam here, or boy, I'm really disturbed now, or all of these kinds of stuff occupy us totally. Yes, that's what the mind does. It does stuff like that. That's fine. No problem. Just be aware that that quality in the mind there where we want to reach in and now we feel like we need to do something about that. What's to do? This is a practice of awareness. Just be aware of what the mind is up to, what it's doing. And nothing to do about that. Last week here I talked about, I used that story of Yaku-san, you know, and his teacher Sekito Kizen came to him. Yaku-san was in meditation and Sekito said to him, what are you doing, he said. And Yaku-san said, I'm not doing anything. So Sekito said, well, then you're sitting idly. And he says, well, if I was sitting idly, I'd be doing something. And so it's that kind of a thing. But then Sekito asked him, so what is this not doing anything? And then he said, even Buddhas don't know. Yaku-san responded. So even Buddhas don't know. You understand? Buddhas don't know. It doesn't mean that they don't know. They know, but what they know is not anything like that. It isn't anything graspable. Whatever it is that you grasp or get hold of, this is not knowing. This is the conceptual. This is the world of our longing and loathing. This is a world of explanation and all of that that we get entangled in and tossed around by. I mean, there it is. What we need to do, what we need to wake up to is to see that and to see how it is that we get caught up in that. Disturbed by that, tossed around by that. It's not necessary. What comes of it anyway? Nothing. But as long as we keep thinking, well, there's something here I need to do, something I have to get this right, or do I have this right? Am I? Don't worry about it. Just notice yourself doing that. And realize you don't have to do anything with this. Just be present. Be aware of what's taking place in the mind, in the surroundings. See, this awareness is there. It is always present with us. Our problem is that we never pay attention to that. Because we're thinking, we're grasping, we're trying to figure out, we're trying to do something. Yaku-san said, I'm not doing anything. Well, then you're sitting idly. Well, if I was sitting idly, I'd be doing something. So he's not doing anything. You say, well, he's thinking then, or he's sitting. Well, what's sitting? What is thinking? What's doing the thinking? Or the sitting? What does that even mean? I am sitting, I am thinking, I am meditating. That's a characteristic of our grasping mind, putting something there and not trying to offer some explanation. Or you know, all the while, of course, we're stuck in that, we're absorbed in that and confused by that. And just, you know, can we just see that? And how easily we get caught by that. And there's nothing doing here, and there's no one seeing this. This is what Buddhas know, but if you try to put it into an explanation, Buddhas don't know. It's the same thing like when Emperor Wu asked Bodhidharma, well, who is this? Emperor Wu getting a little perplexed and irritated by this guy Bodhidharma showing up and not really answering his questions, you know, with anything that Emperor Wu could grasp. And so finally in frustration he says, well, who is this? Who, you know, who are you? And Bodhidharma says, not knowing. Meaning, not knowing. You want me to put something there? You want me to explain something? That's not knowing. But there is real knowledge and realizing that and understanding that. That's true knowing, but true knowing is not something you can say. And I use that analogy with the orange juice. It's still pretty gross, but it's an analogy. It maybe points to what it is I'm talking about here. Well, what it is that you know about that, you can't explain. You can't describe that, what you know about orange juice in terms of its taste, flavor, whatever, to someone else who's never tasted it, so that they can taste it, so that they can know that taste. It is something that's direct. It is not anything you can put into words or into an explanation is not knowing. But it is possible to know that, to have that understanding. But there isn't anyone there, because that's still part of the formed stuff. That's still part of the conceptualized take on what's taking place here. And what the meditation is finally to, in sitting down and calming the mind and being steady, just observing without getting hold of anything, without even an observer. We're not even holding to the observer, myself, here, I, me, in meditation. Like Gyakusan, pretty clunky when he says, I'm not doing anything, but he's forced into it. The teacher asks him a question, he puts it in words. Words will never do it. But Gyakusan is clearly revealing that he understands this. Sekito testing him on that. What's your understanding of this? Gyakusan came through with flying colors. Even though what it is that Gyakusan does understand, the true knowing that's involved in that can't be said. So here we are, and then people come along and they got their machines and they want to know something about this meditation. And how can we use this? You know, yeah, that's where we are. But if you're interested in enlightenment, if you're interested in waking up, just understand what all of that is. And it's fine. It's interesting. It's fun. Sure. But it's not enlightenment. It's not awakening. It's not understanding. It's not true knowing with a capital K. It's not what Dogen, when he spoke of, he says, the Zazen I speak of is not learning meditation. It is the Dharma gate of repose and bliss, the practice realization of totally culminated enlightenment. That's what he's speaking of. And so that's what he's talking about in the Fukan Zazengi. That. The Zazen I speak of is not learning meditation. It's not what we normally do as meditation. We come to this practice, we take it up, learning meditation. We're learning something about this. Of course, we come loaded with our ideas and our expectations about what meditation is and what I'm going to get out of it. Yeah. And now we're going to learn the meditation, we think. Yeah. And eventually we can learn, but it isn't going to be what we learn finally. In other words, when we arrive at true knowledge of what this is, it isn't going to be something that we can explain any more than we can explain the taste of orange juice. But it is something that can be known. And meditating with in this way, this is what Dogen is speaking of. So the Zazen I speak of is not learning meditation. It is the Dharma gate of repose and bliss. The practice realization of totally culminated enlightenment. Traps and snares can never reach it. Traps and snares reach our ordinary kinds of thinking and talking, our conceptualizing, anything that we grasp there, including the self. Traps and snares everywhere. But what he's speaking of is meditation, and that's called Sanzen. Zazen carried out properly as true Zazen. This is, he calls that Sanzen. But in the end, really nothing to say there. So for a long time, we're just engaged in this learning meditation. We don't quite know what we're doing. We can hear these kinds of instructions. A lot of it seems enigmatic because it never quite matches anything that we're carrying to it. So nothing seems to connect there. I don't understand what you're saying. But just stay with it. I remember often listening to my teacher, and he'd say things and I couldn't understand what he was saying. I mean, I could hear the words, I'd get some ideas about it. But I always left with kind of, I don't know, is that what he's saying? It didn't seem to make sense. A lot of that was, and the things that he said and things I would hear kind of helped me to just start giving up on the baggage that I was carrying around with me regarding all of this. Just let it go. Let it go. Till finally, I don't know. I would just come back. I would practice. I'd see the way he practiced, and I practiced in that way. He was there every day. I was there every day. And practicing. And eventually, as Uchiyama Roshi says, it's the Zazen that teaches you. It's just doing it. But when we finally come to a realization and understanding of what this practice is, there's nothing to say, and there's no way you can put it into a conceptual form and hand it to the next person. Like, here, this is it. And that's kind of difficult for us, because we want something. I want you to hand me something that I can grasp. And we don't find that in this meditation. Well, we do, but as long as you are finding things like that, just understand that this is still misunderstanding. And that's okay. There's nothing wrong with it. I mean, we're all there. We all start out there. But little by little, we can learn to just let those things go, let those things go. But you have to practice. Carry this out diligently. Not with a grasping mind like, oh, I must do this so I can get something out of it. Because as we also point out, this practice is useless. You can't use this for anything. But it is a matter of waking up. Because in waking up to this, in waking up to San Zen, in waking up to the Zazen that Dogen is speaking of, this is the Dharma gate of repose and bliss, the practice realization of totally culminated enlightenment. That's what it is. Of course, we think, oh yeah, I want to get that. You know, well, just watch that mind that's carrying on like that. See if you can just set that mind aside, and just go ahead and practice anyway. Most of us, when we start hearing things like, "What's useless? You're not going to get anything from it," we start to think, "Well, why? Can't get hold of it anyway. I can't know it in the conventional way." And we start to give up. That's why I try to tell you the conventional way would be like you knowing orange juice in some explanatory way. That's not really knowing. But you do know orange juice, and you do know reality. You do know the truth. You do know enlightenment. It's just that most of us are not paying attention. Why? Because we're caught up in our thinking, our grasping, our conceptualizing. That's what you have to wake up to. That's what our practice is about. You sit down, you make yourself very quiet, you're not doing very much, and there's a lot of stuff going on there. And watch the mind. I always tell you, watch your mind. Watch that mind grasping and realize that that is the ordinary mind. It is not the mind of enlightenment. What is the mind of enlightenment? The mind of enlightenment is knowing that grasping mind. Enlightenment is really nothing more than understanding delusion. And with that understanding, not being caught in it. So I don't know, did that answer you there, Jay, or did that help you?
I think I got it. I kind of have an understanding of the point for the past 10 years again, starting to understand a little bit. But what surprised me was that they implied, and it would bother me, and I got caught by the fact that mind has a certain electrical pattern.
The brain does.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know that the mind does. I wouldn't say the mind has.
The brain has. And since I just sit there, I can't leave because that much. I try to just slow my mind down and not just notice what's going on. And say things that doesn't sound like a lot of electrical activity to me. So I said, maybe I totally missed something here. But I think you brought me back to where I need to be
Yeah, so you can really, I think, kind of set all that aside. It's probably why those monks over there in Dharamsala didn't participate in the... Yeah, yeah. I mean, if people wanted to come around here and test us here, no, I wouldn't okay that. That's not the point. That's completely missing the point. And it isn't even so much that like that's wrong or bad or wouldn't be good. That's not the reason I would dismiss it. It might be fun. I mean, I'd be, I suppose, I'm just sort of a have a fun experiment. Yeah, it might be fun to do something like that. So I don't have any objection along those lines. The reason I wouldn't have it here is because I'm trying to teach. I'm trying to help you recognize what it is you need to know about this. And that would be a very confusing kind of teaching if I said, well, we'll just do this. I could even sit here now and tell you that, you know, this is kind of useless and don't put too much on this and that sort of thing. It's not our way. But here we are, we're doing it. So I won't do that. Because I know how easily we get distracted and miss the point, you know. It's like that thing, you know, in the psychology classes where I'd take out my little monkey, George. Everybody's mind goes to George, you know. It just happens. And I'll even point that out. You just notice how your mind goes to George. Yeah, but you forget that that was what the lesson was. Or it's like that cow picture in my book. I think most of you are probably familiar with that. And all the letters and things I get on that, and talking about that, and the comments I get. I never, I may have once or twice out of, I don't know, hundreds of responses I've gotten to that. How many people pick up on what it was I was pointing out there? Next to none. And what I'm pointing out there is, again, watch your mind. Notice this, I was trying to help people with a little exercise to help to shift in your mind, to take notice of that. But nobody picked up on that. It's like just this fascination with this kind of this optical thing on the page and all that. Yeah, I know it's fun. It's interesting. I found that fun too. But that's where we'll go. You put something there, little George, whatever, cow picture. Well, what I'm trying to do is to have you notice that that's fine. It's nothing wrong. Don't allow that to happen. But notice how the mind reacts to things like this. Realize what that is. If you want to understand delusion, if you're interested in enlightenment, in other words, start paying attention to that. That's what we need to do. So over and over again, I try to point this out. But the moment I pull up another example, you go right to that. And I say, now watch your mind, what it's doing. But then all the questions I'll get afterward will be all about that thing. And nobody ever asks me for comments. Of course, maybe because there's really nothing to say there either. But and I'm not scolding or blaming anybody here, understand, because this is quite normal. And it's powerful, the way that our minds get caught by this and that. This is why the delusion is so deep and powerful. But I'm just trying to find a way to help you notice it. Anything else? Yes.
This is a question about four, a little question about four, and it's not interesting, but we're talking about maybe it has something to do with lines. And it was just the difference between the gassho and the half gassho.
With the sashu, yeah.
And yes, what is it? Why do we do it that way? And I just had a question about that, actually. Originally, but then when you talk about mind, I was wondering about the connection between the forms we practice, which aren't much.
Yeah, right.
And mind.
Yeah. Well, form is just something to help you, to focus, to get your attention on what it is that you're doing. Yeah. It's also to keep us from, you know, everybody's launched into their own way of walking, entering the room, approaching the cushion, all of this. It gets very busy in here. So So it's a way of composing the room, composing the place in which you're sitting. Of course, if you're alone by yourself, maybe none of these things are really even necessary, except that you do want to be composed. And you, in other words, you want to be aware of how it is that you are entering the room, approaching the cushion, sitting down, all of these things. But in a group, it's good to get that all coordinated. It's also helpful to maybe your assigned ways of entering the room and moving through the room and this sort of thing that wouldn't be your way of doing it. And that's okay, so it helps take it out of your hands, out of the ego's control. Of course, the ego will be there, I don't feel like stepping in that way. You know, well, that's fine. Again, it's always watch your mind. What is that nonsense? What's that all about? What are you preserving there, yourself? For what? At some point, if we become a little bit more sensitive, we can start to notice this insanity that's normally driving most of what we're doing. So these forms are very helpful in that way. Of course, traps and snares everywhere that you load up on too many forms, or they might seem to be symbolizing some deep teaching or whatever, you know. Yeah, and we get just as crazy with that. So can we get rid of all the forms? Well, I don't think so. Somehow we have to enter the room and approach the cushion, whatever. So we need some kind of form there. But on the other hand, you know, we can start loading up too much where we're practicing nothing but forms. And that might be excessive. So, you know, it's the old avoidance of the extremes, that's all. Does that answer your question, Marianne, or...?
Yeah, so the half
book,
I don't know what it's called.
Well, I wouldn't put anything on that. The only reason we do it that way here is because that's what I saw Katagiri doing.
Okay.
And I'm sure if I went and asked Katagiri about it, he'd say, oh, Americans do it that way. So like after Zazen, you know, we got a show like this, and somebody asked him about that. He said, oh, Americans do it that way. Because I remember early on when I had instruction from him, he just instructed us, when you're done with Zazen, you put your hands on your knees. But then, maybe that's how it came up, then somebody else, but everybody does this. He says, well, Americans do that. He says, so I do it too, he says. But when he instructed us, he didn't include that. Mm-hmm. Well, it's also like one time, now we have these Zabaton covers here, so we don't have the threads coming through them with the knots and the little ties, you know. But I remember one time, I think it was something like this, where the people were arguing about that, and he just said, knots up. Okay, so it's going to be knots up, you know. And somehow it deteriorated again or something like this, and people were once again questioning, and maybe not everybody was there or whatever. So we asked him again. He said, knots down. So, in other words, we can get kind of overworked on some of this stuff, you know. The point is, and like what I tell people too in meditation instruction, We tell you to step in with your left foot. It's an act of mindfulness. You know, it's not holy or sacred or whatever. Though there's a lot of symbolism behind that, which I never bother to entangle people's thinking in. I rarely bring it up. If somebody asks, I might. But we step in with our left foot, and then bow and gassho, and then we walk to our place. But what I tell people is, you know, you might not remember. Step in with your left foot. That doesn't matter. It isn't like lightning will strike if you step in with your right foot. But the point is to be aware of what foot you're stepping in with. And so at least do that. And it seems like for a new person showing up, coming in for Zazen instruction, it seems like there's a lot of stuff. Actually, we practice very few forms here. But if you don't know any of these things, I mean, it might seem like quite a bit. But I always try to get it across to people that, you know, don't worry about that. It isn't that you execute these forms correctly or properly or whatever. Little by little, if you come here on a regular basis, you'll see what they are, unless you start tracking somebody who's got their own idiosyncratic way of doing things, but that'll happen too sometimes. But all of that is okay. But the point behind it is to be aware of what it is that you're doing. Realize that we're sitting here together as a group. We're not just composing our own mind and our own posture as we're sitting here. We're composing the very space in which all of this is taking place. And we need to be mindful and attentive to all of that as well. So we are not acting in out of any particular idiosyncratic way. And it isn't like we're squelching that or fighting that or trying to keep that down or whatever. Just let it go. And be attentive. Follow the forms as best as you understand it, as the instruction was. And whether you get it right or wrong, that's whatever that is anyway. I wouldn't be, you know. See, Zen practice, it seems kind of like it should be. It's kind of rigid and uptight. And well, we get into these postures and the way we walk, and then we keep our eyes downcast, all of this. And that can seem kind of rigid, uptight, whatever. Well, we can relax in all of these things. Just carry out the form, you know. So we get into this posture. It doesn't mean we have to sit like this. We can just get into the posture and I'll relax and maintain it. That's what we want to remember in this, and not to be carried away. So you don't want to get lax. At the same time, don't get too rigid with it either. I don't know, did I answer you, Marianne? Okay. Anything else? Yes?
If only I had known that it was going to be like this, I would have come
to the list. Oh, you had a list.
and I'm sitting here trying to figure out how to formulate the question, but the last class that we just come from is really, really impressed me and stayed with me, and I think about it a lot. One of the things that, you know, this business of nothing in particular, nobody in particular, dealing with that and sitting with that, but things come up where I watch the History Channel a lot, I really like that, and, you know, there are seemingly these individuals that are born, had these characteristics, mm-hmm. came up with these ideas that changed the world, did something else to make a change, to make a difference, and something else, and then they died, and now they're buried, and we think of them, and they're in history books, so they are somehow a permanent thing in our mind. And so it's hard for me to let them go, okay, I'm dealing with nothing in particular here, but that person sure looks, you know, solid and real, and they had a free will, they did things well, you know, I want to make a difference too, and so now my next step should be this, and then the whole question of free will comes up, and the whole question of I comes up again, and mm-hmm. I just, you know, it's really difficult, I can't answer the question, and of course I never will, but I would like some help with that.
Well, again, you want the explanation of the orange juice. You want that explained. Like just the question of free will. I think we talked about it a little bit in that class on 10 Zen questions, right? Well, questions of free will, these are flat earth questions, basically. Can you answer why?
Why?
Yeah, why? Whether.
Holding on to the self.
Self, yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So to the extent that we think that there is a particular, you talk about that person in history, you know, they were born, they grew up, they were educated a certain way, they got certain ideas that changed the world, all of this, and then eventually they died, and now they're in the history books, and there they are. And you said yourself that they're very, how'd you put it, they're very real or concrete, but you said in our minds. Yeah, that's where they're kind of frozen into a distinct thing there. But we don't have, we never have had any distinct person, just as you right now aren't anything distinct, nor was that. But what we're talking about is an abstraction. Just take somebody, right now I'm thinking Beethoven. Well, who was Beethoven? I mean, he was a real person. He was born in 1770, and he wrote all that wonderful music, and you know, he really changed things after that. I mean, he had an enormous impact that we still feel it today, his influence in music, even in the popular music, believe it or not. Anyway, for us, in our mind, yes, it's a distinct, solid, real thing that we call Beethoven. But this is just an idea. It's a conceptualized thing. I'm not saying that there wasn't any Beethoven, understand. But what exactly are we talking about when we say Beethoven? And then not only that, what is Beethoven now? Here we are in the year 2010, and we're talking about somebody who lived 200 years ago. So what is Beethoven today? Well, there is this music. There is this image of this guy with the hair and all of that, you know. And
it seems like without him, we wouldn't have this wonderful music.
What we have is today. What we have is 2010. What we have is there's this music that occasionally, once in a while, we come upon it. A few weeks ago, I went to the Emperor Concerto they played at Minnesota, because I had the privilege of going to that. And there it was. So that event today, well, that was already now a month ago. But it shapes this moment now. That's how it is. This is the reality it is now. But this reality of now wouldn't look the way it looks now, feel the way, sound the way it is now, were it not for, that past is here. That's the reality that we're in. But right now we can create this abstraction of some person, Beethoven. Either we've studied him or his music or whatever, know a little bit about his life and that sort of thing, or we don't. Maybe we've just heard the name, or maybe we confuse it with that. What is it, a dog or something like that? It was a movie about a dog named Beethoven. Anyway, but that's where, you know what I'm trying to say here? That's now. And in our mind, we'll think that there was something solid and tangible and real, some distinct thing. There never was some distinct thing.
But his written manuscripts are in the Smithsonian.
Yeah. Yeah. Melody, I'm not denying. I'm not going to the other extreme. I'm talking about the avoidance of these extremes.
It makes it so hard.
It makes it hard if you try to grasp any of this. There's nothing here to grasp. There is this moment. It looks the way it does. It has the content, you know, and we could turn to other historical figures. But that's all now. That's all in this moment. Other people in history you didn't know about, I mentioned it to you now for the first time, or you mentioned it to me, so-and-so, and I didn't know about this character, but there it is. But now, here it is, right here in this moment. But for us to think that we've gotten hold of some real distinct thing and it's back there, there isn't any such thing as that. There's just this here now. And it looks this way. This is the reality that we're living out. This is the thing we never pay attention to, because we're caught up in those abstractions, in the thinking, the stuff that the conceptualized structure of all of this, the things that we can grasp. That's why we're confused. You see? I'm not denying it, but the reality of Beethoven is, or any other character, Napoleon, you know, you name somebody, or even somebody today, yourself, is just like that. We can't get hold of anything. The only way we get hold of anything is, like, as you said, in our mind. But that's an abstraction. And that seems to be a solid and distinct thing. But that's the only place where the solidity and that distinct thing is taking place. But it's an illusion. There's actually no distinct thing. Never was, cannot be. We're reality of that nature. Now we don't have mind. We don't have consciousness. How could there be any knowing? How would there be this? You cannot explain that. It won't make any sense to you. And that's precisely where we are. We try to make sense of this through our conceptualizing. And then we think, well, it's my mind, and my mind is all of this circuitry in the brain. So we put on the electrodes and everything. We want to measure that. And ooh, look what happens when they go into meditation. All this while trying to explain and to get a handle on things. And what I'm saying is, all the while we are ignoring what is right here and what we're missing. the actual dynamic reality of this. We're not seeing it for what it is. And in this we find, yeah, Beethoven, Napoleon, you know, the music, everything. Mary had a little lamb. It's all right here.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost, it puts me in a different frame of mind. It's just, you know, if my husband left me something, and I think,
I'm not talking about throwing any of that away. Yes, so-and-so lived at this time. They wrote such-and-such a piece, and it had this kind of influence. I'm not throwing any of that away. You understand? It's just that the way that we commonly view it, that we naively view it, doesn't make sense. And the only way that we can understand that and see it is to realize that that is what makes this moment the way it is now. Is that that is there as the past, we say. But that past, we think the past is actually back there somewhere. That there's a past over there somewhere. That's totally abstract. What we call the past is occurring right now. It is in this moment. The future is right now. And we won't make any sense out of time in any other way than to realize it in just this way, that it is all thus, now. Nagarjuna shows us this. Einstein pointed us out the same thing. I mean, there it is. Time is a mentally constructed thing, as we naively put it together. Like, well, there's a past back there. What? Where is it? It's now. It's always now. The past is not back there. It's now. And this thing we're calling the past, it contains Shakespeare and Beethoven and Buddha and Jesus Christ and all of this. Or Paul Bunyan and Pinocchio too. I mean, or what? I mean, we say, well, then some of these are real and some are fictional. And it's all the past. And that past is here. Yeah, Paul.
So it's almost like a trick to ask questions.
Well, it's a trick to answer one, I'll tell you. Is that it?
Yep.
Okay. Yeah, Donnie.
I read that there's maybe a relationship or a connection between Taoism and Zen.
Mm-hmm.
Could you say a little about that?
Yeah, actually, Bev studied that, I think, more than I have. But so, if you want to add anything, Bev, I'll just say, when Buddhism moved into China early on, there was a certain aspect of Buddhist teaching that resonated with Taoist teachings that developed in China, 4th, 5th, 6th century BCE. Anyway, there was a kind of a compatibility with that as Buddhism moved in. And of course, we attribute it to then Bodhidharma in the year 4, what was it, 75 or thereabouts, came around Malaysia and got into China and then brought Zen. So it goes. Questionable whether that's an accurate, true, historical, or if there's a fictional account. There's a lot of debates about that. And even Bodhidharma, if he was actually a real person. What clearly is there is that there was this influence of Taoism, and it was very compatible with certain aspects of Buddhist teachings. And these things then, they didn't exactly merge or blend exactly, but there's both of these influences are there, which ultimately came forth in an expression of Zen. The kind of Buddhism that brought forth this flowering of Zen was greatly influenced by Nagarjuna. So it had that kind of a bent. So all of these things just working together brought about Zen. So it has both Buddhist and Taoist background to that. That's a pretty general explanation, but perhaps, Bev, do you want to add something more to that?
I would just add, and it's not even that big a deal. In China at the time, too, they didn't want anything foreign to come in.
Oh, right.
At
mm-hmm.
all.
Yeah.
And so
yeah.
Everything was considered barbaric if it was coming in. But mm-hmm. this was the one thing that seemed to match, and so they allowed.
Yeah.
For
Taoists. And then there's all kinds of lore within Taoists that actually there's some stories that the founder of Taoism actually was the Buddha, that you know, went to India and came back.
But
you can tell all kinds of stories to give legitimacy to your your linear history, which is what you were talking about.
Right.
Try to find answers through some sort of linear exploration of what we call the past.
Yeah. Yeah, and then also speaking of the founder of Taoism, that Lao Tzu is probably a fictional character as well. Even though there's places in China where you can go, you can see where he walked through here and that sort of thing. When Red Pine was here, he had some pictures of where Lao Tzu came through here. And well, that's fine. We can always say that. We can, find a big lake up in northern Minnesota and say that this is Paul Bunyan's footprint here. You know, we can find things and then attribute it to whatever we want to say. But maybe there wasn't a Lao Tzu. Maybe there wasn't a Bodhidharma. Again, these things aren't important. Maybe there wasn't a Buddha. You know, these things aren't really so important. We have this teaching and this practice. This is, and we have right now. And this is what we have now. The Buddha appears to be in this moment right now. Same thing with Lao Tzu and Taoism and all of that. But this doesn't really matter. If we really understand what these teachings are pointing out, because we don't have to hang on to that or cling to that. This might be a problem, say, like in Christianity, bold to say that Jesus never lived. It's fictional. And I think there might be some people who even try to argue that. But that would be a serious problem, you see. But I want you to understand that in Buddhism, these kinds of issues are not critical. Because we're not dependent on some person or some thing or some book or some doctrine or something. This finally is about us learning to wake up here, the knowledge that we can awaken to, the true reality, the enlightenment, is to be found right here and now. These teachings, I don't mean to dismiss these teachings in any way, or to dismiss any of these characters, fictional or not. There they are. And we have all of these different kinds of historical or fictional historical accounts. And they're all very well and good, and a lot can be learned from that and from these different kinds of stories, whether they're clearly fantastic stories or quite plausibly historically accurate and real and that sort of thing. But all of this stuff, we don't need to get too frenzied and worried about it or whatever. What we have is what's appearing now as this teaching, that past, that background. We can look through this and find truly wonderful and liberating teachings. And, well, who was it that said this? And they wrote that, are we talking about somebody who lived centuries ago? Do you really want to get hold of such a person as that? It's convenient for us to talk and say we can identify Lao Tzu or Bodhidharma or whatever, and that's very handy for us. But to think that somehow we're nailing something down like that, we're getting sidetracked once again. We're getting caught up in our thinking, and we're going to get bothered and disturbed by all the wrong things, and we're not paying attention to this incredible stuff that was handed to us now. Because the other thing you should realize is that not only can't you get hold of those people, you can't even get hold of yourself or anybody else in this room or anyone you've ever met or known in your life. So there we are. We naively think we can get hold of different things. But it doesn't work that way. We can't find that. So we can relax about all of that and learn to pay attention to what has been handed down to us as we might speak of it, what it is that we have right here now, and not be bothered by that. See if science uncovers something new. It was very interesting that the Dalai Lama said some time ago, I read it in Time magazine, he said that, I think that's where I read it, he said that whatever science comes up with, if it conflicts with whatever it is that we teach, so then maybe we got to change what we teach. Rather than to sit there and fight with it. But of course, science could also be mistaken. You know, the different kinds of hypotheses and things that it comes up with, they often get amended and changed over time. Zen is about freedom, freedom of mind, and there shouldn't be anything like this that we need to be fearful of. It's only in your grasping and holding to this that this must be so, and that's how it was. You know? This is what's going to disturb us. This is what's going to bother us, frighten us, alarm us, maybe make us feel that, well, this isn't genuine or true or right or real or whatever. holding to in the first place, you know. So, well, we have gone over the hour here, so maybe I better end it. So, thank you.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.